Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The Supreme Court today overturned the conviction of the accounting firm Arthur Andersen for its role in the Enron scandal. Arthur Andersen was convicted of shredding documents to hide evidence of wrongdoing at Enron, one of several blows that destroyed what was once one of the world's largest accounting firms. Joining us from Dallas is Kurt Eigenwald. He's an investigative reporter for the New York Times. He's immersed himself in the Enron scandal and has written a book about it called Conspiracy of Fools, A True Story. And Kurt, do me a favor and first characterize this case for us. How important was this to the Justice Department?
Well, it was more of a marker than anything else. I mean, the Andersen case was not. It didn't pertain to any of the accounting at Enron. It didn't pertain to any of the actual issues that led to Enron's destruction. It was all about document destruction. It was all about obstruction of justice. It was a very fast case. And it was a very controversial case at the time. I mean, you had one individual, a partner, David Duncan, who was pleading guilty to obstruction. And the government then applied, because of his role as a partner at a partnership, applied his actions to the firm as a whole. And that, you know, at the time, led to a lot of controversy.
Well, so why did the Supreme Court overturn the initial ruling?
Well, ultimately, this is what happens in so many of these white-collar cases, that when, you know, the passions are boiling at the beginning, too many people fail to notice them, including journalists. Ultimately, it doesn't matter solely what the facts are. People looked at Andersen and said, documents were destroyed, therefore they're guilty. And in all of these cases, in all white-collar cases, you have a major issue of criminal intent. In other words, you could have the exact same facts presented, and in one instance they're a crime, and one instance they are not. It's not like a murder case or an armed robbery case where the only argument is, you know, is the defendant on trial the one who did it?
Well, tell us what the court did decide, because did the court decide that Arthur Andersen was innocent of document shredding or that happened? Yeah.
No. What the court decided was that the judge in the case, through her instructions, basically established a level of culpability that did not require criminal intent. In other words, the people at Andersen who engaged in the document destruction could have been doing so for perfectly reasonable reasons, or for perfectly for reasons that were not intended to violate a law, and yet still be convicted of committing a crime. And you know, there are two sentences out of the opinion that are particularly striking, where Justice Rehnquist wrote, the jury instructions failed to convey the requisite consciousness of wrongdoing. Indeed, it is striking how little culpability the instructions required. Ultimately, the jury only had to find that Andersen's actions impeded the SEC investigation. And if that was what they found, they could convict of a crime. But again, as you circle back, you have to have the intent to violate the law. It can't simply be, we're doing this and it has the outcome of impeding, and that's good for us, we like that, but we're following our normal rules. You have to say, we're doing this for the purpose of illegally impeding or illegally obstructing this SEC investigation, and the jury instructions didn't require that.
So the Supreme Court overturned the conviction based on legal terms and jury instructions. But what, in the minute we have, what do we learn from this?
What we learn from this is there are no shortcuts. The government did its job. The government's job is to, the prosecution did its job. Their job is to marshal the evidence and to get the best jury instructions for their case that they can get. I would say here that the judge didn't rein them in enough, that the passions of the time allow too often for instructions that kind of gloss over the concept of criminal intent. And when you have that, it doesn't do anybody any good, because then you'll get a reversal. It doesn't mean Anderson's not guilty. It doesn't mean that if the jury had been told you have to find evidence of criminal intent, that they wouldn't have come back with a conviction. What it means is that our legal system is a system of rules. Those rules have to be followed. And you can't short-circuit criminal intent by saying, if it looks bad to you, you can assume there's intent there.
Kurt Ochsenwild, an investigative reporter for The New York Times, commenting on the Supreme Court today overturning the conviction of the accounting firm Arthur Andersen. Kurt, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we'll hear how the fall of Arthur Andersen and Enron have actually been good news for recent college grads who majored in accounting when we take a look at the job prospects for the class of 2005. That's in a minute. But first, all students with college loans may want to consider consolidating those loans before July 1st. That's when interest rates on those loans are expected to take a big jump. By consolidating, a borrower can lock in a fixed rate of interest for the life of the loan rather than have the interest rate adjusted every year. Since today's graduating seniors leave school with an average of some $20,000 in student loan debt, consolidating could mean a sizable savings in monthly payments, but Congress is considering legislation that would eliminate the option of consolidating student loans with a fixed interest rate, so we thought we'd bring this topic to your attention. And to hear more, we have Here and Now business reporter Mark Mills. Mark, welcome.
Hey, Robin.
And why is this July 1st deadline so important?
Well, most student loans have adjustable rates of interest, so once a year on July 1st, that rate is adjusted by a formula based on what's been happening with short-term Treasury bills that are issued by the U.S. government. Those T-bills, their rates have been rising. Remember, the Federal Reserve started raising short-term interest rates a year ago, last June. Long-term bond rates have not gone up over that time, but short-term interest rates, such as the Treasury bills, have risen. So on July 1st, the interest rates on many student loans, such as the popular Stafford and PLUS loans, are expected to go up by almost 2%, according to Sallie Mae, a large education lender. That would increase interest payments, say, on that $20,000 average college grad loan by about $400 a year. In fact, the new interest rate to take effect July 1st will be announced later today based on Treasury bill rates as of today's market close.
Okay, so now we're paying attention. How does loan consolidation help someone avoid this higher rate?
When you consolidate college loans, and many students have multiple loans taken out over the course of their years in school, you roll all your balances into one loan and get a fixed rate of interest for the life of the loan. The fixed rate is based on the average of the rates of your existing loans, but loans taken out in recent years have had a very favorable interest rate in the low-rate environment. You can also extend the length of the term of the loan, depending on the size of your balance. You can even take it out 30 years, so you can be paying for college for almost your entire career working. By locking in an interest rate at the time when rates have been historically low, you can reduce monthly payments and avoid the uncertainty of rates rising in the years ahead. Of course, if rates go down in future years, you're locked in at the current rate. But today's interest rates on Stafford loans, for example, are at all-time lows. So the likelihood of rates going much lower is pretty small if going forward.
Right. Seems it's going to be heading up. Well, is there any downside, though, to consolidating?
Well, you basically get one bite at the apple, Robin. Once you consolidate, you cannot do it again unless you're rolling a new loan into the package. But if you're out of school and you don't take out any more loans, you can only consolidate once, so make it count. Some people who consolidated in the late 90s or in 2000 locked in rates of 7 or 8%, and they're stuck with those compared to the current Stafford rate of about 3.4%. Perkins loans offer loan forgiveness for some occupations like teaching and law enforcement, so those benefits could be lost if you roll them into a consolidation. So there are some individual considerations to make, and borrowers should consult with a lender about what's best for them personally.
And then finally, what about this legislation to take away the consolidation option?
Well, some in Congress, with the support of President Bush, say the loan consolidation program costs the federal government billions of dollars. College loan lenders are guaranteed a certain rate of payment by the federal government. If a consolidated loan does not pay enough to the lender, the federal government makes up the difference. Taxpayer subsidies to lenders for consolidated loans actually totaled $2.1 billion in 2003, according to the Congressional Budget Accountability Office. Supporters of eliminating this fixed-rate consolidation option say those benefits are going to cut payments for college graduates and that the limited money available for federal aid should go for student loans to current students rather than graduates. Mm-hmm. The consolidation option would remain under the legislation being considered, but would switch over to a variable rate of interest. So if rates rose, the borrower would be taking on that risk, not the federal government.
So bottom line, pay attention. Here and Now business reporter Mark Mills. Mark, as always, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, a crucial part of the college loan equation is a job. You need to work to make money to pay back your loan. So what is the job landscape for the class of 2005? Andrea Kuntz is with the National Association of Colleges and Employers, NACE. They survey both students and companies to see where the job are. And Andrea joins us on the line from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. Andrea, what did you find this year? Are more graduates finding jobs this year than in years past?
Well, this year our employer members told us that they plan to hire 13% more new college graduates this year.
Than last?
Yes.
And last year, a couple years before that, in fact, back to 2001, it's been kind of a drought for jobs for college grads.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, give us some context. Is it as good as it was, let's say, back in the 90s during the dot-com boom?
No, not anywhere near that good. For example, when we did our 2001 survey, the employers predicted they'd hire 23.4% more new college graduates. That was probably the highest point where we ever were. In 2002 and 2003, the employers predicted decreases in their hiring of new college graduates. Last year, in 2004, the increase predicted was 12.7%. So we're making our way back slowly, but I doubt that we'll ever get back to where we were at that time in 2001.
Right, when young people were handed jobs and BMWs at the same time. Well, let's hear a little more about what's happening now. First of all, who's getting the jobs? I understand you have a top 10 list. What majors are on it?
Accounting was first. Electrical engineering was second. Mechanical engineering was third. Business administration and management was number four. Economics and finance is number five. Computer science was six. Computer engineering is seven. Marketing and marketing management was eight. Chemical engineering is nine. And information sciences and systems is number 10.
Whoa, if I was graduating this year, I'd never get a job.
No.
do the liberal arts people fit in anywhere?
Actually, we don't get a whole lot of data on them. Typically, what we've seen over the years is that they're not so specifically targeted, but it doesn't mean that they won't get jobs.
We understand that starting salaries for liberal arts majors are expected to increase by 4% after a decline last year. Let's talk about salaries. Are companies increasing wages across the board?
Yes. We also produce a salary survey report where we're seeing more increases overall to all the disciplines, including liberal arts. And when we did survey the employers in the Job Outlook survey, I think it was 71% of the respondents said they plan to increase starting salaries to new college graduates. However, the average increase is about 3.7%.
Andrea Kuntz is with the National Association of Colleges and Employers. And speaking of salaries, we thought it was worthy to note that college grads still make about $9 more an hour than those without a degree. Well, our conversation about job prospects for the class of 2005 continues. We're going to speak to a city councilor from Fort Wayne, Indiana, who wants to pay new graduates to live in his community. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're talking about today's crop of college graduates. As we've heard, it's a good time to be graduating with a degree in accounting, but salaries are pretty much up across the board. And Andrea Kuntz watches these trends for the National Association of Colleges and Employers. Andrea, it sounds like there's a lot of competition out there for new graduates. What did employers you surveyed say?
I believe 70% or so did say that they are seeing more competition among employers for the best and brightest students this year. Most of them responded that they would combat that competition by offering higher starting salaries. Mm-hmm. We wanted to see if they'd offer more signing bonuses, maybe more benefits, but it seems that we're not at that point yet, that we're still looking more towards higher salaries.
They're not giving away the BMWs yet.
Right.
But what are students asking for? What are they interested in?
We asked our students in our graduating student and alumni survey what the top benefits are that they'd be looking for. And number one was medical insurance. I think that's typically been at the top of the list.
More than salary.
Right. That was actually number two, yearly salary increases, 401k retirement plans, tuition reimbursement, and dental insurance. I think life insurance was up there as well.
Andrea Kanz is with the National Association of Colleges and Employers, NACE. They survey students and companies to see where the jobs are. Andrea, thanks for speaking with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
So where are these new jobs? Well, NACE found that the Midwest has more job opportunity for new graduates than other parts of the country. But tell that to the people of Fort Wayne, Indiana. Dr. John Crawford is a city councilor in Fort Wayne. He's alarmed at the number of graduates who are not settling in the area. Dr. Crawford, we understand you have a plan. What is it?
We have a plan where we're trying to make our city and our state more attractive than some of the other places where the graduates are getting offers from. There are certain fields that are in very high demand, and these are in the high-tech, high-demand areas like engineering and advanced manufacturing, computer software engineering, biomedical, biotech. So a graduate coming out of there might have 5-10 job offers. Now, Fort Wayne, Indiana does not have any mountains, doesn't have any seashores, and isn't particularly known for its exciting nightlife. So some of the things where another city might attract these students, we don't have. So one way we went at it is to set up a fund, and we call it the Brain Gain Fund.
As opposed to brain drain.
That's right. And the idea is if a person comes here in one of these high-demand areas and they work for a year, at the end of a year, we will pay off $2,500 of their college loans.
Whoa, where are you getting that money?
Basically, we've raised it from economic development funds and my own self. It's something I'm very interested in, so I'm donating my city council salary each year to it.
We understand you're an oncologist by
yes.
trade. So
yes.
how much of your salary did you give up?
The entire city council salary.
$30,000?
Yeah, per year.
Now, that's a big chunk of change. Why?
Basically, just because I don't do city council for the money anyway, so I usually would donate it to other things anyway, so I decided just to concentrate it on this to kind of get things going, because it helps you a lot when you go to a foundation and you say, we'd like you to help out some money, and they say, well, who else has given? And then you say, well, I have. And that helps them, make them know that you believe in it yourself.
Well, I guess the other question is, you know, why as to... How important is this to have young people? I'm wondering if you've seen some of the studies we've seen that show that the cities and towns that can get young people to live there are the ones that are going to thrive.
Correct. And we can show you some good data. In about 1979, 1980, at the time of that census, Fort Wayne people made an average of 103% of the U.S. wage, because we have a high concentration of manufacturing jobs, and back then those were the jobs everybody was after.
Yeah.
And now, 20 years later, the average Allen County or Fort Wayne resident makes 83% of the U.S. average. So what's happened is some of those manufacturing jobs have went away, and relative to the, you know, information age jobs, which are more high-tech, high-skill, high education jobs, they're not as high on the pecking order as before. So we need to reverse this slide. And these graduates are kind of like your economic seed corn of the future. You know, you need them to populate the jobs that we already have. For example, there's a company here in Fort Wayne that's in software design, and they have 40% of the U.S. market, and they need design engineers, and they already have the business to expand to 50% of the market, but they can't find these engineers. They've even tried to get foreign people, but there's a limit on the visas. So there's jobs waiting, and then they say, well, every time we find somebody who's qualified, they say they've got another job offer, they're going somewhere else.
Right. So you propose $2,500 at the end of 1 year. Is that for anyone, or do you screen people?
No, it's just for we're starting out in the advanced engineering fields that I mentioned, and advanced manufacturing, computer software, design, engineer, biotech, biomedical.
So it's $2,500 per year. How much do you, what's your cap?
And 4 years, $10,000.
And what do they have to spend it on?
They have to pay off their college loans. So in other words, basically, the way it works is you apply for this and you have a college loan, and at the end of that period, we pay off your college loan to the person who holds your loan. So many of the kids are coming out with a lot of debt now, and that's a sort of an attractive thing. And it's something kind of unique, because very few people are doing something like this. Some people do scholarship funds, but if you do a scholarship, you never know if halfway through the studies your computer software design engineer decides to go into, you know, art or something, and all of a sudden you don't have what you thought you have, and you got to get the money back, and, you know, maybe they'll come, maybe they won't. In our program, they've already done everything we want. They're in the field we want. They've come to this area. They've stayed a year. And the idea is, if we get people to come and stay and work in Fort Wayne, they set down roots, and they usually like it. It's the initial attraction that we're working on, and we feel that if this gives us something different, like let's suppose you're a graduate, you're getting out, you've got a lot of debt. One place is going to pay off $10,000 of your loans, and the other one isn't. If they were even, then you'd go with the one that was going to pay the $10,000. Now, if it's, you know, if it's a huge difference, you're not going to overcome it with this, but it's just one more arrow in the quiver.
Dr. John Crawford in Fort Wayne, thanks for speaking with us.
Okay.
Much more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Financially strapped school districts across the country are struggling to come up with creative ways to hire teachers, pay for school supplies, and maintain extracurricular activities. So imagine a school district turning down a $380,000 windfall from parents who wanted to donate money for a popular academic program. Well, that's what happened recently in Wellesley, Massachusetts, after parents opened their checkbooks to save a Spanish immersion program that offers elementary school students an hour a week of classes with a native Spanish-speaking teacher. Joining us first on the line to talk about all of this is Doreen Higgins. She helped spearhead the fundraising campaign. She has two daughters in the Wellesley School District, and one of them was taking Spanish immersion. Doreen, welcome.
Thank you.
And first of all, tell us, what reason did the school committee give for not taking $380,000?
The school committee is really constrained. They're not allowed to take money that is to pay teacher salaries. And you have to remember that these were seven teachers that were actually employees of the school system.
And they said that this would be crossing a line to take private funding for public school teachers.
They were worried that this is a slippery slope, that nobody really wants to go down, that if they took our money, that in future, if other overrides failed, then the PTOs would just pop in and pay for things like creative arts and athletics and so on.
That's right. So the taxpayers could ultimately just figure out, hey, wait a second, let's not vote for any higher taxes because some parents will come forward and cover the costs.
Absolutely correct.
Okay, well, that's the school committee side. We're going to take a look at this issue nationally in just a minute, but this issue all came about after residents narrowly voted against raising taxes, and the Spanish immersion program was one of the programs that would have to be cut. What was your reaction when, you know, other parents were voting against things like your program?
A lot of people got very, very angry about it. The parents were very, very concerned about the quality of the children's education, and was this the beginning of an erosion?
And why is it such an important loss to you? Your daughter, Katie, is in the fifth grade. She's been taking part in the Spanish immersion program since second grade. How do you feel she's benefited from it?
There's been a lot of research that shows that children have a narrow window of opportunity in language development that helps them for a very long time in critical thinking, raises SAT scores and so on. It helps in the long term.
Well, so you and other parents were angry that the program was cut. You're worried about, an erosion in the quality of your children's education. And you turn around and raise money. How did you raise $380,000? Did somebody give a huge amount?
No. The interesting thing is, this was across the board just a grassroots effort. Our smallest amount was $5 that somebody had in their pocket, and they pulled it out and said, that's all I can do right now, and we said thank you very much. Average, it was about $332. Many, many people gave that in their check.
Well, and have you now given the money back?
Yes, we did. It was a sad day, but we gave every one of the checks back.
Well, Doreen, do you sympathize with the feelings of school committee members that if, you know, voters know that parents are going to come up with money, they'll always turn down taxes, or poorer schools won't get programs that rich schools will get if parents are doing all the subsidizing?
I must say, I absolutely could understand their decision. I wish that we could have postponed the vote that evening so that we could sit down at table and do some creative brainstorming as to what they could do. How could they take that money potentially and help us work with it before school program so that everyone across the board could benefit.
So you feel that, in effect, the poor people are still going to be hurt?
Absolutely, because this was a program run through the public schools that every single child had access to, and now we're talking about either, well, in all cases, a paid-for program, which is going to limit the number of people that can actually afford to do that.
Dorian Higgins helped spearhead a campaign that raised $380,000 to try to save a Spanish immersion program at Wellesley Public Schools. That effort failed. Doreen, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Well, we now want to take a broader look at how the issue of parent fundraising is affecting schools throughout the country. And joining us to do that, Glenn Kuchar, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Association of School Committees. And Glenn, first question, many people are saying, well, school districts routinely accept money for extracurricular activities, the arts. So what's the difference between that and these parents raising money for a Spanish immersion program?
Yeah, Robin, great to be talking with you about this. One of the major differences is that in many situations, the money is given directly to the district without strings, so that the school board or the school committee, as we have here in Massachusetts, will be able to deploy the monies they feel is most appropriate. But you're absolutely correct. There's a very fine line between what happens when the Friends of Hockey or the Friends of Music provide money for an extracurricular activity and parents go out and raise money for something that is considered part of the basic core curriculum. It's a real ethical dilemma in many respects for school boards, and it's a very hard choice to make.
Well, why is the choice made against, in this case, the parents raising money for Spanish immersion? I mean, you know, what is the fear?
Well, it's because the parents have decided that a particular program is very important to the core curriculum, and they've gone out and raised targeted money specifically for something, and that may not be consistent with the policy of the district in general. And I'm speaking in a global sense now. I'm not specifically talking about Wellesley, Massachusetts. I'm talking about the principle of the governing board making an overall global decision about what's best for the school district and what's best for the curriculum as a whole.
In other words, a fear perhaps that you might have special interest groups deciding school curriculum.
Well, not only that, but what happens next year? They raise the money for fiscal year 06, but that implies an obligation for fiscal year 07, and what if the school district is not in a position to make a long-term commitment in this very challenging economic time when we don't know what's going to happen with the economy, what will happen with state or federal financial assistance? It's very hard to accept those commitments to make those policy decisions if they're in fact influenced by what another group is doing externally.
And does it also lead to perhaps taxpayers getting a little lazy in their thinking?
That's a very legitimate concern. You know, during economic crises, unions never give back pay raises. And they're very, very reluctant to accept a year in which they get no pay raise at all for fear that the voters will say, great, when we get squeezed tightly by the economy, we'll just squeeze the union and they'll go along. It's the same principle. We're very fearful that voters will turn around and say, well, if people are willing to raise the money, why should we raise it? Let the parents do it.
Right. Well, what is this a big issue for other schools across the country? Have you seen efforts like this with parents raising money for things on the curriculum?
A recession impacts everybody all over the country at the same time. And nationally, we're seeing trends, including the imposition of fees. If you asked a Massachusetts school district, you might find that as much as two-thirds of students pay fees. Around the rest of the country, the proportion of students paying fees for some kind of extracurricular activity is increasing. Transportation fees are increasing. It's getting very hard as the economy gets bad.
Given those problems, do you see a greater role for the private sector in funding public schools? Maybe not parents, but private funding.
Well, we have many school districts have gone to grant makers, private funders, corporations, but it's the district going to the funding source saying, here's what we need, would you be willing to make a grant? Right. And I do anticipate, you know, in the future we may be having another ethical decision about whose money is appropriate to take, what comes with strings and what doesn't. At a time when there's so much pressure on kids to be eating healthy and schools to do more in physical education, what are we going to do if a food vendor offers to create a scholarship program or to fund other programs or to buy the scoreboard at a stadium? We've had naming rights as issues in school districts, and that will challenge us to think very carefully about the examples that we set, how we set money, and how we convince the public to support the public schools financially.
Glenn Kuchar is Executive Director of the Massachusetts Association of School Committees. Glenn, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
We also spoke earlier with Doreen Higgins, who helped raise $380,000 from parents to save a Spanish immersion program in Wellesley, Massachusetts, but that money was turned down by the school district. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Well, if you're eating your lunch, you may want to put it down for just a second, because we're about to discuss some fascinating medical news, but it involves spit. Researchers say that within the next few years, spit may replace blood for testing for illness, with an act as simple as spitting in a cup at your dentist to look for cancer, or as high-tech as an implant inside your mouth that will monitor saliva to determine heart disease. Joining us in the studio to talk about these new advances in medicine is nationally syndicated health columnist and Here Now contributor Judy Foreman. Judy, welcome.
Hi.
Well, this all sounds very sci-fi, but let's start with a simple spit test. Aren't there already some saliva tests on the market?
Yes, there are. There are quite a few. You can test for alcohol consumption and illicit drugs and the HIV virus that causes AIDS. Some of them you can do at home, and some are done in institutions.
And what is it in spit that enables you to do this? I mean, what is spit? What's saliva?
Saliva is a liquid, and obviously it moistens food, but it has a lot of the same components that blood does. It has a lot of DNA and RNA and protein. If you have a virus in your system, that would show up in saliva too. So a lot of things that we now use blood to test for, we could use saliva instead.
And how would dentists use it? What would they be looking for?
And it might not just be dentists. I mean, dentists could use it for testing for oral cancer. Right now, they can do that by looking very closely at your mouth and sometimes swabbing it with special chemicals. But they could do this. If this got to the point where it was a screening test, they could have everybody who comes into the dentist be screened for oral cancer, which is a really nasty cancer. And down the line, as the tests get better, they could screen for breast cancer, type 2 diabetes, heart disease, because the proteins that they would be looking for in a blood test, those same proteins are present in saliva.
And you mentioned the benefits of saliva over blood. And I'm thinking one would be how you retrieve it.
Yeah, there are many benefits, actually. Yeah, it's much easier to retrieve. You don't have to stick somebody with a needle. That means ultimately it could be a lot cheaper to test saliva because you don't need a phlebotomist to take your blood. And it's, you know, obviously painless. And you can monitor things more closely. Like if you have an infection, you could monitor hour by hour, as often as you wanted, how the virus level was going in your body. Whereas with blood, you'd have to take a sample invasively.
So if you took an antibiotic, you could take several tests over the course of a day to figure out if it's working.
In theory, I think you could do that, yeah.
Right. Well, the National Center for Dental and Craniofacial Research is compiling a catalog of all the proteins in saliva. How's this going to help researchers?
Yeah, it's a really cool project. It's called a proteome. Everybody's heard of the genome, which is all the genes in your body. The proteome is all the proteins that are made by these genes. And so the researchers out in California are doing a study of normal, healthy people's saliva and looking for all the proteins that are there. Once they know the normal levels of all these standard proteins, then they'll be able to use saliva tests to see, you know, if somebody's protein, a certain protein goes up or down and sort of strays from the normal, which would allow you to detect certain diseases way earlier than any other way.
Well, now, looking to the more high-tech usage of this testing, you say in about 5 years, we might actually have an implant on the inside of our cheek that would monitor saliva. How would that work?
Well, it would be a tiny little thing. In theory, it wouldn't get in the way of chewing or swallowing or singing or whatever. And it would just be sort of like a little sensitive piece of material that would detect when protein levels got too high or too low. And I mean, the imagination is the limit. You could have it beep when something happened. I'm not sure I'd want something beeping in my mouth.
As you write, it could send messages to your doctor.
Yeah.
If you're having heart problems.
That's right. If they could measure something like C-reactive protein, which is one of the proteins that they use to monitor potential heart disease, you could check your saliva for that.
Right, Judy Foreman, one last question before we let you go. We understand that technology is catching up with what people have long suspected about the importance of saliva.
Yeah, I mean, saliva has a whole little history of its own, and one of the legends about it is that in certain primitive tribes, saliva was used as a lie detector test. And they would give an accused person a handful of rice and say, swallow it. And if the guy was too nervous and had a dry mouth, he couldn't swallow it. And it was assumed he would be guilty.
Well, of course, he could have been nervous about being tested.
Exactly.
Judy Foreman, syndicated health columnist, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And to read Judy's column on the future of spit testing, go to our website, here-now.org, then go back to your lunch. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And this year marks the 75th anniversary of an athletic feat which riveted the world. When golfer Bobby Jones captured all four of the sport's major titles, the U.S. and British Opens and the U.S. and British Amateur Championships, the first time anyone had done it. In fact, the phrase Grand Slam was borrowed from bridge just to describe his accomplishment. Then, having pulled off what no one had done before or since, Jones abruptly retired from competition. Some younger golfers may not even know there was a giant before Nicklaus, before Woods. The legend of Bobby Jones is explored by Chicago Sun-Times sports columnist Ron Rappaport in his new book, The Immortal Bobby. And Ron joins us from the NPR studio in Chicago. Welcome, Ron.
Thanks, Robin. Good to be with you.
And, you know, the subtitle of your book is Bobby Jones and the Golden Age of Golf. Can you, you know, just remind us, why was that golf's golden age and how did he fit in it early on?
Well, golf was really just becoming the great spectator sport and participant sport that we know it to be in this day, Robin. It really wasn't like that at the turn of the century. Americans didn't play golf. We didn't follow golf. It wasn't one of the sports that we paid a lot of attention to. But with the coming of great players like Jones and Walter Hagen and a number of others, all of a sudden it began to become this great event and great kind of sport that we know it as today, both as from a spectator and a participant point of view. And Jones was one of the people who brought it into this kind of light because of his own personal magnetism and his qualities. It sort of set him apart from the other athletes in the golden age of sport in the 20s, and also because of his brilliance as a golfer.
Tell us a little more about that personality, though, because you write even sports greats such as Babe Ruth, Bill Tilden, or Jack Dempsey didn't equal Bobby Jones' appeal. I mean, you remind us that, is he the only person ever to get two ticker tape parades in Manhattan?
Not the only sports person, Robin, the only person ever. Nobody got two ticker tape parades.
What was that? What was it about?
Well, it had to do with the fact that he was viewed differently from the other athletes in that era. He didn't take a winner's purse, although, as I point out in the book, he made a lot of money from golf after he retired. He also had this great education. He had a literature degree from Harvard. He had an engineering degree from Georgia Tech. The only reason he didn't graduate from law school is that he passed the bar in his second year. And he had this way of carrying himself that just seemed so calm and relaxed and gentlemanly. The people were simply captivated.
I'm going to read back a paragraph that would be almost unthinkable today. Bobby Jones loved opera, pondered Cicero. If only I thought as much of my golfing ability as Cicero thought of his statesmanship, I might do better in these blamed tournaments, he wrote. He discussed Einstein in the fourth dimension and relaxed after a competitive round by soaking in a hot tub and reading Giovanni Papini's Life of Christ. And he was
amazing.
An athlete, yes.
Amazing when you think of it. On the other hand, he also had the common touch. He loved nothing more and having a couple of stiff belts of homemade corn liquor. This was during the Prohibition. He loved hanging around the golf course talking to his pals.
But that's when, you know, he began awing people. Early on, he had a terrible temper. And as you write, I think he lost 10 tournaments before he won one.
That was another thing. He burst onto the scene quite literally at the age of 14 when he did very well at the U.S. Amateur in Marion, Pennsylvania. And he played so well that he became headline news around the country and perhaps the most famous little boy in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. Well, for the next 6 or 7 years, he couldn't really seem to capitalize on his fame. And he came very, very close a few times. He had a terrible temper. Grantland Rice said that he had the face of an angel and the temper of a timber wolf. Finally, he learned to control it, and when he started winning, he never stopped.
Tell me about his game. What was it? I'm not a golfer myself, but, you know, my dad, my brother would love hearing this. What was it about his game?
The swing. you see the pictures today, and they're being shown on the Golf Channel, and they're being shown on DVD, and in some movies that he made in Hollywood after he retired, where the greatest stars in Hollywood vied to play with him for free to be in these movies that they showed in theaters and were very successful. I'm talking about W.C. Fields, Edward G. Robinson, James Cagney. And you look at this swing, and it was gorgeous. Robin, I found the last surviving person who Jones played against in a Grand Slam tour, Eric Fidian in Hanley Swan, Worcestershire in England, 93 years old. And as he was talking about playing against Jones, his eyes kind of lit up, and he said, you'd stand there on the tee and you'd watch him swing, and you're supposed to be trying to beat him and thinking about your own game. And you'd watch Jones and you'd say, by Jove, that's lovely, isn't it? Mm-hmm. On the other hand, as great as he was at the game, his failures drove him absolutely nuts. And even though he retired at the age of 28, it was probably the best thing for his sanity to do.
But was it too late for him physically? Bobby Jones was in some sort of terrible disabling pain when he died in 1971. You come to the conclusion that it may have been that beautiful swing?
Yes. He spent the last two decades of his life in a wheelchair with his condition getting more and more terrible, and towards the end he was almost completely paralyzed. And it's long been believed that he had a disease of the spinal cord called syringomyelia. There are several doctors who dispute that, and one in particular who has studied the case in great detail. But whether he did or whether he didn't, all during his career, there were incidents where he would have a creak or a click or a clack in his neck. He would feel pain. Once he almost defaulted from a British amateur. But he would go through, and then he would feel better. But it's very clear in looking back at that, and I showed these reports to the doctor I'm talking about, and he almost winced, saying, this is a man in serious trouble. This is a man who needs exercise, which was not in vogue then, who needs treatment. And it's very clear that the game that he excelled at, like no other, almost certainly put him in that wheelchair.
Hmm. Well, I'm wondering what conclusion you came to on another topic. Was Bobby Jones an amateur? Late in his life, one of his foes charged that he took money to play in tournaments. So what did you think, Ron Rappaport? It was such a great part of his appeal that, you know, people thought he was just like them.
It was part of his appeal, and the truth of the matter is he never took money for playing in a golf tournament, and that raised him to this higher level as being this true sportsman. But when he retired, he made the bulk of his living for the rest of his life off golf. He made these movies I'm telling you about in 1931 and 32, that as the Depression was tightening his grip, he made $250,000 making movies in Hollywood. He made Bobby Jones golf clubs that were sold until after his death. He wrote a lot. He was a very wonderful writer. His autobiographies are charming today. He got paid for that. And Jones was not at all coy about this. He didn't hold himself up to the high standards that sometimes other people did for him. He said when he retired, now I will serve golf and golf will serve me. So, yes, he was an amateur. But you have to understand what amateur meant then. It's not the same thing as today.
Ron Rappaport, was Bobby Jones the greatest golfer who ever lived?
You can make a case for it. There's no question about that. He was certainly the greatest of his era. And remember now, he played on courses that weren't as well groomed and well kept. He played with hickory clubs, not steel. He played with golf balls that weren't as good. The question would come up later, in his retirement, and he would say, in all fairness, I believe this is true, you can only judge a golfer by the people he plays against in his era. But it certainly would be something to see him going against in a national championship, against a Jack Nicklaus in his prime, a Tiger Woods now. It really would be something. You can only speculate that when he was on his game, when he was playing the best he could, it's hard for me to believe anybody could have beaten him, Robin.
Chicago Sun-Times sports columnist Ron Rappaport, his new book is The Immortal Bobby, Bobby Jones and the Golden Age of Golf. Ron, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Slow shadows crawl across the course, to leave your back on that old rack and stroll on over, hit the 19th hole. I'll call my baby, tell her I've been late. We'll drink to the 7th. that you took on eight.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Join us again here and now.
Carry us away. Sipping in the shadows. Talking about.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.